Welcome to the Well Said podcast, presented by Speech First.
Free speech on college campuses under attack.
They usually weaponize harassment policies and bias reporting systems.
The lawsuit filed by Speech First claims that TSU and its officials have, quote, deter, suppress, and punish constitutionally protected speech.
A petition from Speech First, a First Amendment group, called for the dean's removal. Well, now the dean is on leave.
Here's your host, Charisse Trump.
Welcome, everyone, to Season 3 of Well Said. It's been a busy year already for Speech First, which is why we had to take a short hiatus between seasons. But I'm excited to get back on a roll with the show. As many of you know, Well Said is a podcast hosted by me, Charisse Trump, Executive Director of Speech First, a free speech advocacy organization. And on the show, my goal is to interview policy experts, commentators, academics, students, and activists on topics of higher education, free speech, and other related topics in American culture and policy. You can share this episode on Facebook or YouTube, as well as any podcast platform such as Apple, Spotify, Anchor, and now Ricochet. You can download the episode and listen anytime. If you like what you heard today, give our podcast a 5-star rating and go to our website, speechfirst.org, and press donate. Okay, today on our show, I'm very excited to have Karen Lips, president of the Network of Enlightened Women and author of the recent book, You're Not Alone, The Conservative Woman's Guide to College. Karen is a graduate of the University of Virginia and the University of Virginia Law School and practiced law previously at Wiley Wren. She speaks frequently on conservative public policy solutions, feminism, and equal pay. She was also previously listed in Fortune 55's Most Influential Women on Twitter, named Red Alert Politics 30 Under 30, and was selected for the Forbes 30 Under 30 list for law and policy. She was also previously awarded the William F. Buckley Award from the Young Conservatives Coalition for her work in leading the Network of Enlightened Women. Thank you so much, Karen, for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me on. I'm excited for this discussion.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm looking forward to it. So just to start us off, our listeners, for the most part, know there's a lot happening on college campuses right now that has created hostile environments for conservative students in particular. What's most interesting about your work is the focus on conservative women. Let's start off talking about the organization you lead, Network of Enlightened Women. You know, what's its origin story? What inspired you to lead it? What is the growth? Like, what have we seen with Network of Enlightened Women? And what's the motivation behind all of that?
Well, I am from Indiana originally and went out to the University of Virginia for college. And during my time there, I spent a summer interning in Washington, D.C. for my home state senator, Senator Lugar at the time, and really enjoyed that environment where there was a lot of free exchange of ideas. There were discussions. It wasn't so militant, like Republican versus Democrat. We really got in the nuances of arguments and talked about how policy proposals in DC that maybe sounded nice, how they would actually impact people, including young women. I returned to UVA for my third year of college and sought out an environment like what I had found in DC and was really disappointed that none of the women's groups seemed like they were open to more conservative women. So I even went to our women's center, which you would think, Charisse, at a state-funded university, the University of Virginia, a building which has a big sign that says Women's Center, you'd think that it would be open to all women. Unfortunately, that was not my experience. I scheduled a meeting with a faculty member there. She took me around, but I could tell that things were pushing a leftist agenda. Yeah. At the end, I asked, would they be interested in co-sponsoring a new group for conservative women? She just looked at me like I was crazy, chuckled, and said, "Not here." And that's when I started.
Not here. Wow. That's not like pretty here. Direct. She wasn't even trying to sugarcoat it for you.
No. But it just shows how much leeway that I think many in these different institutions feel like they have if they can treat a conservative student like that. So yeah. I started the Network of Enlightened Women Are New as a book club, actually, because I really wanted education to be the main component. I wanted to talk about books and ideas that were maybe presented unfairly on college syllabi, or quite frankly, in many cases, just left off college syllabi, and started the organization. And within 6 months, some students at William & Mary heard about it, wanted to get a chapter going. And now we've spread and grown into a women's leadership organization with chapters on over 60 campuses. We've done events with big name conservative women like Nikki Haley and Dana Perino and Senator Marsha Blackburn, and have just had some great discussions and really created this community for conservative women, which I think is a demographic that's often belittled or worse on college campuses, and have created this intellectual home and community for them, and given them a place where they can talk about ideas, bring speakers like yourself. I know you've got some speaking events scheduled at some of our campuses coming up, and just bring some intellectual diversity to campus, and in a way normalize conservatism among young women and help fight against some of the social pressure and silencing that these young women face.
Yeah. And that's an excellent point there when we're talking about the fact that most women on colleges probably feel obligated to participate in more left-leaning organizations because that's what they're told is the acceptable behavior of women on campuses, unfortunately, that you have to be pro-abortion or that you have to be, advocating for LGBTQ rights as a woman who is that supposed to be a given that's suddenly like as a woman you support all of these things. But that's why it's so great to have alternatives for women who are like, wait a second, I don't actually sign on to any of that stuff. Is there something there for me? So you said 60 plus campuses. That's huge. That's really great. Is it like country? Is it across the country? Are you focused in specific regions? Are you guys still growing?
Still growing. And it really is dependent on the leadership. I mean, Charisse, you find these all-star leaders on campuses and it's incredible what they can do. So it's really focused on finding those great leaders. And then we try to provide resources for them, books. We have a speakers list to bring in speakers. We'll provide some grant funding, provide scholarships for those leaders to come to our leadership retreat in the summer. So it's about really investing in these leaders who can be ambassadors, not only to their peers on campus now, but hopefully in the long term, truly be ambassadors for conservative ideas and freedom.
That's something I'll say too, is you guys had me at the leadership retreats last summer.
Yes.
It was so fun to meet all of the young women who are, motivated to kind of take this to the next level. But it's fascinating because I always tell folks this too, there's a lot of people who are kind of saddened by what's happening on campus, or, they have a negative outlook on the future of the younger generation in politics, just because they're seeing a lot of what they're seeing is on social media. You see these crazy outbursts and rioting and like weird behavior. But when you actually, and I tell these people, when you go to these campuses and you meet these leaders, especially the conservative leaders, and when I met all the young women at the Network of Enlightened Women's Leadership Summit, that was so fascinating because they're so much more inspiring. You're like, oh, wow, I actually feel good about the future, because these are like driven people who are smart, they're intellectually curious, they're organized, and like they actually have a good head on their shoulders and they had good upbringings. And it's so inspiring to go to events like that. It reminds you that there is hope for the future. And so,
there's nothing better, Charisse, than giving a speech to one of our groups and having them all be like taking all these notes. And you're like, okay, good. Like they're listening. they're really eager. They want to learn and be leaders. So, I know in our retreat, especially, I love that.
No, it's really, really great. So I want to talk about your book. I have it here.
Yes.
You're Not Alone, The Conservative Women's Guide to College. Let's first talk about because you've been doing this for a little while now. So what prompted you to write the book? Like, what have you been seeing on campuses that you're like, okay, now we actually need to put a guide together because there's some serious problems here that need to be addressed. There's conversations that aren't happening. And they need some sort of, resource, like a handbook to kind of like help give them, chapters that are broken down by subject to really address a lot of the problems that we're seeing. So what kind of inspired you to do the book? Were there any incidents that occurred that you're like, we need more tangible items to give as a resource to our students?
Over the years, I've noticed, Charisse, that a lot of the students are asking the same questions over and over. And so we kind of got to a point on our team that, questions would pop up and then we'd, refer back and say, oh yeah, I remember how we answered it in this case. And I just came to the conclusion that it would be really helpful if we could actually be more proactive and give these students a guidebook or a handbook or some information that they could have early on so then they can anticipate what they might face. And I hope all of the students out there don't face everything in this book, but I guess that a lot of them face some of it. And so giving them, you know, the tools and the resources for then how to deal with those situations. So I'm very clear in the book that I'm not telling them what to do, but I want to identify like what are some potential issues for them and then give them some strategies or, you know, even point to some other organizations like Speech First that they can go to if they do face one of these issues. So the goal in it is to really prepare them and not only the students, but also their parents or grandparents, whoever maybe buy the books for them. I think this gives a good survey about what's happening on campus too. So it's not just for the students, but just gives an overall look of what's going on campuses today. Yeah. And so it can really serve as a resource for, you know, those who get those phone calls from students who are like, what do I do in this situation? It can be helpful for them as well.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. And there's so many good, like I mentioned, some good chapters in here, sections that really break it down for students. You mentioned some of the questions that you regularly get, some of the incidents that you guys see on repeat. What are some of the biggest challenges you've been seeing lately that women are facing on college campuses? Because, I mean, we can all list off a few, and I think you definitely address some of the major ones in this book, and I'd love to really unpack a lot of that, you know, talking about corrupt student governments, obviously the transgender movement and the attack on sororities. Like, I would love to just talk about sororities. I've heard from so many female students that there are issues with trying to be leaders of sororities if you're a conservative woman or if you have specific views that don't go in line with the far left LGBTQ movement. Also, of course, you know, Riley Gaines, the athletic programs and what we're seeing there. So I'd love for you to kind of break some of that down for us and outline some of the major problems you're seeing.
Well, it's interesting. Over the years, there's some that are common, right? So over the years, students have often told stories of facing kind of unfair liberal professors. So there's, you know, a chapter in there on that. And some of the advice I give is to, for example, think about, you know, when is it going to be productive to speak up or not? You know, sometimes I think it's easy to just kind of blurt something or like jump in. But really encouraging students to think, okay, is it productive? Am I going to change someone's mind? Am I going to make this conversation more interesting? What's going to happen? So I think being a little more strategic there is wise. I also think sometimes there's a story in there about a student who got a bad grade. And, you know, sometimes I think now that it's out there about that professor, just avoiding certain professors, unfortunately, is a strategy that I know a lot of our students employ. And then one other strategy in that section I've listed is if you're going to try to make a point that is more conservative, maybe, but that liberals agree with, at least some do, try to quote them. So try to cite liberal sources sometimes for conservative points of view. Hmm. And one example of that is on free speech. Like Barack Obama has even said that it's not good for campuses to just shut down all alternative viewpoints. So if you're trying to make a free speech argument for a speaker on campus, maybe you quote him to a liberal professor and maybe that will make it a little bit more compelling. So I think the professor, I would say, like narrative dealing with unfair liberal professors. And I'm careful to label that because I think there are fair liberal professors. So it's really identifying those who are unfair. I think that's a narrative that's been going on for years. Something we're seeing pop up more and more now is that some of our clubs are really struggling to get registered or recognized by their schools. And one of the benefits of being recognized is often it leads to classroom space availability. So then you can book, you know, book speakers, book events. Also, it often opens up funding opportunities. So there is an advantage to getting recognized at a lot of these schools. Right. And we've seen student governments say no at one school in the South. A student government said no. In part, they listed out one of the reasons was that there was already a women's organization on that campus. So they didn't need another one. It wasn't unique. Right. And you think like, that's the problem, right? Like you assume that all women's organizations, everybody's going to think the same. So you only need one. Well, that's part of the problem. And so we've been pushing back on that. But I think that's where sometimes I'm concerned, and I imagine you are too, from a free speech perspective, that sometimes when people or students are gaining power, like in student government, they are wielding it in a way to censor or shut down voices And that's a problem because when I was in school at the University of Virginia, I felt like there were hundreds of clubs and the approach was more, the mindset was more, it was of the mindset basically that, you know, let's let the market determine if students want these clubs or not. So if somebody wants to start a club that, you know, is political or not political, or maybe seems to be like a small interest, let them try it. And if there's demand, it'll work. And if not, you know, it won't last long. But instead, some of these schools now, both students and administrators running the recognition process, seem to be kind of putting their hand on the scale and trying to make substantive judgments about whether a conservative women's club is necessary or not.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure, I don't think they've got a true understanding of the challenges these women face and the benefit this club will be to them. So I mentioned that as a something that we're dealing with now popping up more and more. And so we're keenly aware of that issue right now.
Yeah, I've been seeing that a lot with conservative clubs generally is that they, one thing is the Student Government Association. I think a lot of people don't realize how much money they have control of in the, you know, when it comes to spending on campus, it's usually in tens of millions, hundreds of millions of dollars worth of student activity fees, depending on how big the campus is. So they get to determine how that's allocated based on which clubs they choose to recognize. It used to be that, you know, if you're, yeah, I get the argument that so therefore there's limited resources, there's a redundancy issue that they have to figure out. But it is kind of telling when all the redundancy issues come up when it's conservative organizations or conservative clubs, and they are in the minority on campus. So I highly doubt there's a serious redundancy question regarding conservative organizations, because everyone knows that a majority of clubs on campus, a majority of students on campus are relatively left-leaning, if not neutral. They're not necessarily conservative ideologically or want to pursue conversations in that realm. And I think especially since, you know, the student governments have been really, just the students in general have been really hostile towards conservative speakers on campus. When they see an organization that has national resources to bring in speakers that they're going to disagree with, they see this as an opportunity to silence those voices by not recognizing those clubs. And yeah, you're right. It's a clear-cut case of viewpoint discrimination. And this is why it's so important to have faculty allies on the campus, because the way I've seen students get around this conundrum is by having a faculty member who's willing to be, you know, not only the sponsor for the club, someone who has to like sign and say, I'll be the advisor, but also willing to kind of show up and help defend the club when there's a hearing to defend it, to advocate for it.
And someone with that institutional memory.
Yes. Right? So and they know the other administrators, they know the departments, they can, because these students who are running SGA, they're like in charge every now and then, but they just follow the lead of whatever administrator is kind of running the show.
And then they graduate.
Yeah, exactly. So it's absolutely, especially when you're a club that wants to have longevity on campus, that faculty mentor is highly important. How do you help students find these faculty mentors? Because when it comes to conservatives, there aren't a whole lot that are willing to be public about their positions on issues.
I'm glad you bring this up, because this is one of the most fun chapters to write in the book, is that I included a whole chapter on finding a conservative faculty mentor.
Yeah.
I think that is something that more students should do, because it's not only helpful when you're a student, but it's also a great way to build a relationship with someone that will last for years after college. I mean, I still stay in touch with some of my professors. I asked Mary Kate Carey, who is on the board of NEW and is an adjunct faculty at UVA. And she wrote a nice essay for that chapter. Wonderful. And gave advice. And I think it's important for students to remember, this is for the students listening, that these faculty members choose to be faculty members, right? Like they could probably spend their time just writing or maybe just researching, but they want to be with students. And so you're not imposing on them by going to their office hours or sending them an email or trying to get to know them. And so I was delighted to be able to feature Mary Kate Carey so they could like see what one of their faculty members maybe thinks about all this. Right. And she gave some great advice about writing thank you notes and how to approach a faculty member. So there's some good tidbits in there about how to not only identify someone who might be a good faculty mentor, but also then how do you start and build that relationship. Because I really think, I mean, Cherise, it's very helpful in your career beyond college, right? Yeah. Like they can help you write those letters of recommendation, serve as references, not only for those first internships, but also for jobs years later. They also often, like when they invite speakers to campus, they might be able to invite students to go to dinner, and then you could end up meeting someone that leads to an internship. It's just helpful to have those relationships. So I do think that's one area that I would love to see more students take advantage of and do more to build those relations.
Yeah, being able to identify, once you identify someone who can be a strong ally, I can trace the beginnings of my career all the way back to a professor I had in undergrad that was an advisor.
That's awesome.
So it was an advisor to a club I was involved in. He's the one that wrote recommendation letters for me for these fellowships. They're the ones who usually know about the fellowships that you would in particularly find interesting. They're the ones who know kind of the lay of the land, not just on campus, but obviously in whatever career path you're pursuing. So they are definitely incredibly valuable to a student's experience and, of course, to what they plan to do afterwards after they graduate. Let's talk a little bit about, so you address a little, some of the kind of lifestyle, kind of social issues that, you know, a lot of conservative women face on campus, especially when it comes to concepts like advocating for feminism or, you know, because a lot of these, I don't really know any women who are like anti, you know, especially conservative women who are anti-women or anti-feminism, and that they want to advocate for, conservative women's lifestyles. They're not trying to say, you know, women shouldn't have rights. There's a kind of like a weird disconnect between what most would classify as like the feminist movement, right? And then conservative women. And they really have a hard time kind of navigating that conversation. So I saw in the book that you have some advice here for women, young women to kind of talk about women's rights. And I think you even have this term opportunity feminism, which I found really interesting. And I would love you to kind of like break that down and explain what that is exactly.
I'm so glad you asked about that. It's interesting. It's a real challenge that I think young conservative women face when, on the one hand, you have the modern feminism, which seems not only just to not fit with their worldview, it seems to be a leftist narrative, an ideology that just doesn't fit and doesn't accept them, right? So it belittles them, it ignores them, it tries to silence them. So there's a disconnect there. Yet, I think a lot of young conservative women want to be part of a truly empowering women's movement.
Right.
And so if it's not going to be in today's modern feminist movement, where can they find that home? And so in working with students over the years, I've recognized this. And I started giving speeches on what I called opportunity feminism, or a brand of feminism that seeks to maximize freedom so that women can build the lives they want to build. So this means, you know, giving women more options for the work-life setup that they want, rather than trying to pigeonhole women into kind of one view of what women want. And Cherise, I'll get into the weeds a little bit here, one example of this, this is a victory that we just had as an organization, is my background, as you mentioned in my introduction, is in law. And one of my law school friends came to me and raised the issue that in one state where she was trying to get recognized or licensed, because she moved and states regulate the practice of law, so you've got to get you got to get licensed by the state. There was a full-time work requirement for her to get that license without having to sit for the bar exam. And the bar exam is a barrier to entry. And the state had decided that if you reduce your hours to part-time instead of full-time, then basically you're penalized. And we know that a lot of people reduce their hours to care for young children. So it seemed like this was something that was going to impact, or was already impacting, a lot of mothers of young children. So at noon, we filed a petition with the Supreme Court of Tennessee. We're still waiting that decision. It's been almost 2 years. But in the last year, we filed a petition with Ohio, because they were one of the other five states that had this full-time work requirement. And I'm delighted to share that the Supreme Court of Ohio approved the language change and removed the full-time work requirement. So now, if you're a part-time lawyer, you move to Ohio, you do not automatically have to sit for the bar examination. You can be eligible for admission without examination.
Yeah.
So again, a little bit in the weeds, but I think that's a good example of an occupational licensing reform issue that maybe, you know, it's not getting national attention, not going to impact everyone, but can really make a difference in someone's life when they're deciding, okay, do I have to spend the whole summer, you know, nights and weekends away from my children to study for the bar exam? Or do I decide, oh, I'm just not going to practice. What do I do? This gives women more opportunity. And so in opportunity feminism, what I try to do is let's find an empowering version of feminism that recognizes the position of American women in the world and advocates for some changes like this licensing reform change where it can make the difference in the lives of women.
No, that's actually a wonderful example, because I think a lot of folks associate feminism with kind of, you know, obviously the historical associations of like the right to vote and suffrage and whatnot. But the more recent wave of feminism, like we can ignore some of the far left radical stuff, but kind of ultimately even just your average person would be like, oh yeah, feminism's good because it like advocates for women's like equal rights in the workplace and in education and all of these things. So like, and that, of course, again, I'm leaving out all of the crazy radical stuff that is associated with it today. Because, you know, sexual liberation and all this nonsense, but ultimately that's what most of the average people would say that they associate feminism with. What they forget to associate feminism with is this freedom that you talked about, giving women the choice to be able to properly raise their children in a good home, with the possibility of a dual income household to make it easier on them. But these barriers that are still in place that the current modern feminist movement just completely ignores, because for them, they're like, oh, women don't need to have children. That's just going to hold you back. Or women don't need to have husbands. That's just going to hold you back. You should just work full time all the time. And so there's like, they completely leave out the realities, right? Which is that women want to be able to have children. They do, for the most part, want to get married and have kids and have a family and also maybe pursue a career. There's a lot of barriers in front of them for that still to this day, even though feminism has been around for a long time and haven't really helped out much in that regard.
It's a mistake for the left to assume that all women just want like 9-to-5 traditional jobs, because the survey data tells us that's actually not true. That in fact, a majority of moms with young children would prefer some type of part-time work. Mm-hmm. And so I get frustrated when I see leftist policies come out that try to just, you know, create one image and push one vision about what women want, when actually I would love to see more on-ramping and off-ramping options, more part-time options, you know, a lot more flexibility in the economy so that then women can pursue what they want. And I recognize that it's different, right? Like different women want different things. I just want to have more opportunities so that we can try to match up more women with like what they actually want to the jobs in the economy.
Right. Absolutely. And on that note, so I'm curious for the Network of Enlightened Women, like, how do you respond to people, especially on campuses, who claim to champion women's rights, yet go out of their way to silence conservative women, either in your organization or in other places on campus?
It's a real challenge. And one of the things I do in the book is I call out a couple of these institutions where we see a lot of this. So there's a chapter on women's centers, women's studies departments, and other leadership organizations, which you see the name of them or the label and you think, oh, this is great. Like, I'm a woman. This is a women's studies department or a women's organization. It's not unreasonable for your initial reaction to be like, oh, this will be great for me. And I think a lot of students assume those programs are non-biased and not political. And then they go in there and suddenly they're getting pushed left. So I think it's important to identify some of those programs that are often pushing a more leftist agenda. So from an institutional perspective, that's one thing I would watch out for. And then in terms of the peer-to-peer interactions, that's really tough, Charisse. And I actually included more on that, because when I was interviewing students, so I feature about 30 students and alums of our organization in the book, let them share their stories and strategies. That was an area where I got a lot of feedback, a lot of responses, because it seems like a number of our students had, you know, not just had people like look down on them or like ignore a comment or something, but had truly lost like best friends. Like there's one story in there, somebody talking about how she lost her childhood best friend after she went to a conservative conference and started speaking up and posting about conservative views. And that can be devastating for a college student. You know, so many students don't go to school just for the academics, but also for the community and the friendships that they think will last, you know, be lifelong friends. And so definitely address some of those social interactions. And I truly encourage our students that, you know, there are other conservative women out there. There are other their peers out there who are open-minded.
Yeah.
You just got to really take some steps to try to find them. So starting from day one, you know, go to your student activities fairs, see what conservative clubs are out there and really get a sense of the tone. Some are more educational, whereas some are more activist, and figure out what tone feels right to you. Then when you're, you know, trying to find picking classes, for example, make sure you pay attention to what those peers are like in classes so you don't end up picking a major where all of your peers are leftists who are closed-minded, right? It's going to be hard to find.
That's a part
there.
In the book that I found really interesting that you write about, like, be careful when you're thinking about your majors and just be more conscious when you're thinking about your course selections, because you have to, unfortunately, as a conservative student, you really have to pay closer attention to these things. It's not a given.
Right. And you're going to be spending a lot of time with these students and these professors. So you don't want to be miserable by spending time with a bunch of people who are closed-minded and think that your view doesn't count or doesn't matter or isn't, you know, worthy of being heard. That's not helpful to anyone. So as you mentioned, I've got a whole chapter in there about picking a college major. I think a lot of students could use a little more thoughtfulness in this area. Right? Like trying to figure out, okay, where do I want to end up after school? So how can I pick a major that will lead me there?
Right.
And for some, we all know, we all have those stories, right? Like some people, it ends up to be more linear than for others. But I think giving it some thought and acknowledging that maybe things will change, but at least giving it some thought is good. And then I do break down some of the numbers. There's some studies in there about how, Democrats are less likely to be friends with Republicans who voted with the opposing presidential candidate.
Yeah, I could see that.
So, it's like some of those studies, I think it's nice for students to read this because then they can understand like, okay, well, if they're so close-minded, maybe that's not a friendship worth pursuing anyway.
Right.
And then you make the point that it's, you know, not every relationship has to be political. Like, follow your interests, find your hobbies, find other people to talk about things with. That, like, it doesn't have to be political. You can have friends that you watch the debates with, and you can have friends that you cheer on your college football team with. So, you know, don't.
This is why I think so many students are struggling because it's becoming more and more, even like the student life aspects are actually getting more and more connected to politics. Like when we just touched on athletic programs. I mean, you could do a whole episode just on that. We have actually, we had a couple, we had previously had a swimmer on who was a UPenn swimmer who had to swim with Will Thomas and like be in a locker room with him. And it was just very uncomfortable for them. And it became like a big political thing. You couldn't speak up about it. You were completely silenced. Sororities, you know, if you want to be in a leadership position of sorority or even participate, oftentimes if they find out on social media or in other ways that you are conservative or politically different than them, then they find ways to squeeze you out and push you out. So I know there's advice in the book about kind of handle situations like that, but I think also a lot of it goes to what you were just saying about making sure, you know, choose your friends wisely, try to find things that you have in common.
And find that community, invest in that community. Yeah. And it can be on campus, but also things like your podcast, right? Like our organization has a podcast, the Conservative Woman's Guide. Like, find your resources where you're going to get news, where you're going to learn about issues so you can anticipate issues. And if one of your so-called friends does something that you're like, that seems weird, but you might end up listening to the podcast or being part of an organization and realizing like, oh, that's part of a trend that how leftists are like treating students on campus. So that's actually, you know, a signal that, you know, it's not worth pursuing this friendship, right? So trying to figure out where to invest your time. But I'd say more and more really investing in that community makes a big difference for our students.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And that's one thing when we're talking about community, and we'll kind of wrap up with this because I'm curious to kind of just overall what news experience has been on, you know, just the level of importance to connect conservative women on campuses and just kind of generally in life. I do feel like there is a lot of isolation that can happen because they're so outnumbered in a lot of the institutions that they operate in. I'm curious though, like how has NEW helped in this way? You know, what do you see as like kind of some of the very important factors with regards to making sure conservative women are being connected? And then, of course, I'd love to get your take on like just the case for optimism, which is, of course, what I always like to try to end these episodes on.
It's good to be positive. You know, I'd say one of the benchmarks that we pay attention to a lot, it's a little bit more intangible, but figuring out how our organization is impacting the individual lives of young women. So one of the women featured in the book is Cameron Teal. She's a student and one of our leaders at University of Arizona. They brought in a speaker, Christina Sandifer, who's a leader at the Goldwater Institute, one of the state-based think tanks in Arizona. And that ultimately led to Cameron getting an internship there. And I know she's doing well in that internship. It led to a fellowship. So I think her leadership in New and spending time in the chapter has now led to kind of her career trajectory. And so I think that's a good, you know, story of success. Yeah. And so for us, I think it's investing in these women and trying to be the change for them, trying to connect them to other conservative organizations, to, you know, books and materials, to advanced training. We offer a student media fellows program. I do an online course on opportunity feminism that really gets into the policy. So really trying to serve as a resource for them and deepen our relationship with them, so that they can be effective ambassadors for conservative ideas, not just when they're on campus now, but in the years to come. I mean, I love following our alums and seeing what they're doing and the differences that they're making in their communities and in their jobs. And so for me, it's, you know, really watching that and tracking it and making sure to continue to create a community and programs that these young women want to be part of.
Yeah. And I think that's, you know, it's in the name too, Network of Enlightened Women.
Yes. So
that's really where the emphasis is, I think, for the organization. And I know if anyone wants to learn more about Network of Enlightened Women, you go to enlightenedwomen.org. And Karen, you're on social media and so is the organization. So they can find you that way as well. Feel free to, I don't know what the exact tags are, but feel free to list those off.
Yes. If for Instagram, New is at Enlightened Women and I'm at Karen.lips. And then on Twitter, X, it's at New Network, and I'm at K-Lips. So I'd love to hear from anyone who's listening to this podcast.
Yeah, absolutely. Anyone who wants to join the organization, I highly encourage it. Again, they have a very good amount of resources for students. So, you know, I've seen it firsthand. They know who to refer students to when they're hitting roadblocks on campus. So there's organizations like us, of course. And then if they bring in speakers, and again, emphasis on the network, I think, is really key here. Well, so real quickly, you kind of touched on it a little bit, but like case for optimism, like what's, are you seeing a kind of a growth? We obviously see the optimism with the growth of your organization, but what's going on campuses? What are some of the positive things that you've seen happening since you've started working at New?
You know, I'd say whatever the left throws at conservative women on campus, there's always those women who are willing to fight back. And so I think seeing that, okay, you know, it might have been faculty bias, students would speak up against that. And then you have administrator bias, then you've got the student recognition issue. They can't silence all conservatives on campus. And in fact, sometimes that backfires and really makes our students want to speak up more. So seeing those individual cases of women facing really struggle, you know, tough times, and fighting back, it just emboldens them even more to be leaders and to speak up. And so I think it's those individual stories are what makes me excited that, you know, they can keep throwing things at them, but these women are ready to respond and speak out. And so that makes the future of conservatism bright.
Great. That's very exciting. Like I said, I always like to end on a positive note if I can. Well, thank you everyone for joining us today. I think it was a wonderful conversation. I hope you learned a lot. Check out the book, Conservative Women's Guide to College. You Are Not Alone. Great, guide for any students out there, but also just conservative women in general. I think it kind of gives you some insight, especially with the amount of stories that are told, firsthand stories in that book. I think that's really, really informative for anyone who's kind of operating in this field or is just a conservative woman generally. Well, I'm Sharice Trump, and Karen, that was well said.